Dave. Appreciate that information. That's good stuff. There's whenever we reach a point, can you hear me okay on this thing? Whenever we reach a point where we think we know all there is about feeding cows, which you think ought to be a simple enough operation, there's something that comes along that we maybe need to look at, and I appreciate Dave giving us some of that information. How many of you have gone to the restroom from this room in the building? When I got back, I had to go again. I mean, it took me a long time to get down there and get back again, but so I hope some of you aren't feeling the effects. I'm going to try and go fairly quickly here, but maybe I should introduce myself if you don't know who I am already. I'm Jerry Stuck. I'm with Pfizer Animal Health, one of their veterinarians. Used to be at K-State. I know there's some Kansas people in the audience who I know very well. I currently live in North Dakota. Is there anybody here from North Dakota? There we go. Good for you. See, people actually live in North Dakota. Okay? I just wanted to prove that point.
Why?
Leave me alone, Daryl. You're already picking on me. I do have a little bit of a story, and I want to tweak my marketing people just a little bit with this story. And I'm not very good at telling jokes or stories all the time, so I had to write myself a few notes. Sometimes, believe it or not, sometimes actually marketing people tend to oversell things. I know you might find that hard to believe, but it actually is true. It turns out that there was a cow-calf producer, and some of you may have heard this story, and I just had to use it after what Dave was talking about. It turns out there was a cow-calf producer. He was either in southern Oklahoma or Texas. You know, it probably isn't going to matter here. But he didn't have very many cows. He had like 17 cows. And he called a veterinarian to come out and preg check these cows, and it turns out it was one of those producers that some of you, maybe not in this room, are familiar with, didn't have any facilities or any panels or anything like that. Veterinarians love that sort of thing. I got to tell you, how many veterinarians are in this audience here? See, they already got the picture in their mind what this was like. Took them a half a day, 17 cows. None of them were pregnant. Okay, the veterinarian obviously was a little puzzled by this and asked the guy, "Well, you know, where's your bull? Maybe we need to take a look at your bull and do some semen evaluations." And cows are in great shape. And the guy says, "Well, doc, I didn't use a bull this year. I just fed them breeder cubes." I guess that's actually a true story. So, you know, sometimes marketing people get a little bit carried away. Anyway, I'm going to cover a fair amount of ground, and hopefully we won't run out of time. And I hope that there's something that when you leave here, I've given you some things to think about. Some things to think about that actually follows up from what Daryl was talking about and his group, and follows up what Dave was talking about. And we are going to talk about vaccination just a little bit, okay, at the end. And there's some things I want you to think about in terms of vaccination and immunity that maybe you haven't thought about before. All right? So follow along with me. And the first slides, this will be good for you. And it's a good thing we're before lunch, but the good thing about the first slides I have is that there's a lot of pictures. Okay? All right. Actually, this is North Dakota. This is northeast. I bet nobody, does anybody in here know where Hebron, North Dakota is? Okay, this is northeast of Hebron, North Dakota. Beautiful country. Too bad not very many people get to see it. Is there any way we could dim the lights just a little bit more? I use this slide quite a bit, and I'll bet you there's some people in this room that have seen me use this slide before. In fact, the joke that I kind of tell people is that I never change my slides. No matter what talk I give, I never change the slides, okay? And I'm guilty of that just a little bit. So if you've seen this before, just kind of hang with me. What I point out in this slide is that there's some common things between these three pictures, okay? And that we as cow-calf, beef cattle, beef food production people need to have this in mind in this country. Okay? And I'm just going to point out that this is a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, this is a John Deere tractor, and this is a New Holland haybine. Okay? And I want everybody in this room to understand that the same idea that goes into being able to sell a Harley-Davidson motorcycle for more than $20,000 that has two wheels, no air conditioning, and no power steering is the same mentality we have to have right here in the cattle that we produce and in the food that we produce. If we don't, we're going to get our butts whipped. Okay? We're not in the commodity industry in this country. We have to have the idea that what we produce has a tremendous value. So therefore, whatever we put into those animals, whether it be feed additives, fat supplementation, vaccines, antibiotics, how we handle those cattle, okay, has to be with the idea that all the inputs are of the highest quality that I can possibly find and use. Okay? Little soapbox. You may have seen this data before. We in this industry tend to dwell on a lot of negative things. We hear how tough it is and how bad it is, and I know it's not easy from year to year. What amazes me thinking about this, so we actually got paid less for our calves this year with $79 fat cattle than we did last year. I still haven't figured that one out, okay? But there's some things that we can control and things we can't control. It's more difficult for us to control how much money we actually receive than to be able to control some of this stuff here. This kind of goes along with what the first group was talking about. Okay, this cost of production issue. I know we didn't go there a whole lot, but that was the underlying theme with a lot of that bull selection discussion was this cost of production. I want to share this data with you because I think there is real opportunity still in this business. Okay, this is Barry Dunn data, South Dakota State University, just from a couple years ago. Okay, it's data that I believe that I can trust. It's primarily from South Dakota herds, one in North Dakota, and I think a couple in Nebraska. I'm not going to point out all these numbers on this whole chart, but I'm just going to focus on a couple of them. Okay? What these columns are identifying in Barry's categories were medium profit, low profit, and high profit herds. Okay? Let's just look at these two columns just for comparison. One of the things I want you to notice is that the high-profit herds wean more calves. Okay? We need to save more calves. However we do that, less open cows, maybe we feed fat. We lose less calves from scours. We have whatever reason that we don't end up with a high percentage of calves weaned, we need to correct that. The other point I want to make about this slide before I forget is that we cannot be average in this business. Economists love to look at averages, and that's okay to look at it, but we got to be a heck of a lot better than average. We got to be the A and the A minus B plus guys all the time in this business. And if we do that, there's opportunity. Okay? The next thing I want to focus on, I want you to look at, is this thing right down here, this calf break even per pound. And I know these numbers might actually be somewhat difficult to believe, but I trust Barry Dunn in putting this stuff together, and so therefore I trust this data, and I wanted to show it to you. Perhaps many of you have seen it before. I want to compare these two numbers. Low-profit herds, which is incorrect, of course. If you're producing calves for $1.36 a pound, unless you're in the seed stock business, how many years will you make money as a commercial operator? Never. Okay? Look at these herds over here. 41 cents a pound. Is that possible? I'm not saying everybody in this room can achieve 41 cents a pound cost of production on a weaned calf. That's phenomenal. My point in showing you this, though, is that there is opportunity in this business if we make some of the right decisions. If we make some of the right decisions concerning genetic selection, which we spent a lot of time on this morning. If we make some of the right decisions concerning nutrition of those beef cows, lowering that cost per cow per day, costs over the wintertime or over the summertime. We can achieve some of these costs of production. Is it easy? No, it's not. And you have to have numbers in your own individual herd to be able to make the right decisions that will push you in that direction. Okay? Look at this return on assets, 18%. Outstanding. Okay. Being a veterinarian, I have to make a case for veterinarians. Okay? I got to tell you this. We in the veterinary profession have a little bit of a crisis going on. We do not have enough young people entering into our business, the food animal business, to really keep things going. Okay? We don't know how to solve this issue, all right? And I don't necessarily have the solution either. I'm just telling you that if you have a good veterinarian that you work with, be very kind to your veterinarian. Be nice to him. Pay your bills as quickly as you can. Don't gripe about them, okay? He needs to live and maintain, and he does, most often, he does you a tremendous service if you use him in the right fashion, okay? I just want to point out what health costs generally run. They're anywhere from 3.5% to 5% of the total cost of maintaining a cow. And I just tweak you a little bit with an example, because sometimes we chase this thing really hard. We say, man, I'm going to save 25 cents a dose on some vaccine here. I'm going to really hit a home run. The problem is, in the cow-calf operation, you really don't make a whole lot of progress chasing those things. Not telling you that you shouldn't be wise and frugal when it comes to health costs. Everything that you spend, all of your inputs, requires careful, I guess, careful logic. Careful, you know, is this the right thing to do? But my point here is that because these costs are very obvious to you at the end of the year, we tend to focus on them perhaps more than we should and decide, well, let's cut costs by cutting out a dollar. How much does $1 per head difference make in terms of our cost of production? I've used this example. If we're producing calves at 60 cents a pound, health program costs are 5 cents, that's about 3 cents a pound cost of production, and I spend $1 less, that amounts to about 0.0015 cents. Okay? Don't get me wrong, I'm not telling you not to scrutinize this area. I'm just telling you that there's areas in cost of production that you can make a whole lot more progress. And remember, be kind to your veterinarian. All right. Lots of pictures here, okay? But I'm going to try and drive home this point that Daryl and his group tried to make this morning as well, okay? That there's a lot of decisions that you make on a yearly, monthly, weekly, daily basis that greatly influence your ability to be profitable and also greatly influence your ability to produce a healthy calf crop, okay? And I begin with talking about genetics quite a bit, but I'm going to relate that back to the health side of things primarily. Even though we're going to talk about reproduction, I can't ever do this without getting over this health aspect. All right? Okay. Sometimes as a veterinarian, if I'm called out to an operation, Daryl, and we've got, you know, 20% open cows, maybe we've had a scours outbreak in the last couple of years, some kind of a problem, and the problem for you guys is right in front of me. I got too many open cows. I'm in the middle of a scours outbreak. And just show me or help me to get through this thing, get rid of this problem. Sometimes as a veterinarian, you go out and you realize there's a lot of stuff out here that cannot be corrected very simply. And so sometimes, and I'm trying to be very kind here, sometimes the kindest advice I as a veterinarian could give a person is to maybe consider this. You know, maybe you ought to sell out and do something else. This isn't going to work. You don't have enough lifetime to correct what's going on out here unless you sell out and start over. Okay? That's the magnitude of the problems we can get into if we don't pay attention to this stuff. In other words, if we've got in our mindset that genetics kind of lie over in that corner, and our health issues are over here, and nutrition's over there, and things are over here, and they're all separated, you can get yourself into that mess. The reality of it is, all those things are rolled up into kind of a barbed wire ball right in the middle. All right? They're all interrelated. Okay. I won't spend much time on this slide here. We spent quite a bit of time looking at EPDs and trying to pick bulls. And I applaud the Gelby Association because they got a lot of stuff there that's very, very valuable for us as cow-calf producers. I have just chosen to use two Angus bulls and give you just a very small number of EPDs. Okay? One of the things that we all needed to pay attention to this morning, and I think it was brought up, what's the accuracy of most of these EPDs on yearling bulls? High or low? It's extremely low. Believe it or not, we can actually make pretty horrendous mistakes if we're not careful and do a lot of homework when it comes to this bold selection issue. And I'm going to relate this back to health in just a little bit. This is just some EPDs that I made up on these Angus bulls, but they're probably not very far out of line. My point is, in showing you these, is that there's a lot of things that the EPDs don't tell us either. I wish they could tell us everything, but they don't. Okay? There's a lot of homework that we need to do in addition to. And that sometimes, perhaps, these bulls that we bought here, which look fairly similar and have EPDs that are very similar, may in 5 years end up looking like this, provided they're under the same nutritional conditions. Okay? And we may have made some mistakes here that we didn't really want to make. And it's because we didn't do enough homework. One of the interesting EPDs that I saw in that Gelby Association was stayability. How long does a female stay in the herd? That's a big deal as far as I'm concerned. Okay? Which of these bulls, provided they're under the same conditions, nutritional conditions, might be the bulls that we'd like to keep heifers of that would stay in that herd for a long time. Okay? Probably this one over here, I would say. Alright? Okay. Just a couple slides to kind of set this up even more. In this business of managing our herds such that we can lower cost of production, get as much value for them from those calves as we possibly can, and yet produce healthy calves. Okay? And I'm sure there's some of you in this room that have heard me kind of give, in a way, this sermon before, but there's no event that's more important in the life of that calf than what happens in and around this thing right here. Okay? This birthing event. How much stress or how little stress is on that calf at that point has a big impact on the lifetime health and productivity of that calf. Okay. Well, how big is it? How much difference does it really make? Okay? This is some fascinating data. I got two slides. Follow with me very carefully here because there's some numbers that, yeah, I don't know that you want to remember the numbers, but it kind of helps to make the point. Louis Perino and Tom Whittam put together an article a couple years ago in the Journal of Vet Research. And they measured calves. They measured the amount of immunity in the calf system at 24 hours of age. And what they found was that those calves that didn't nurse or didn't nurse enough for whatever reason, look at this, 3.2 to 9.5 times more likely to become sick and 5.4 times more likely to die prior to weaning. I don't know of any event that's greater in the life of that calf that is a greater risk factor for sickness and death than that. Whether that calf gets up and nurses, how much he nurses, so on and so forth. Huge risk factor, okay? Well, since that time, there's been a little tweaking done in looking at that. And remember this number here, 800 milligrams of IgG per deciliter. Okay, that's in the serum of that newborn calf. That's how much or how little these calves had, which isn't very much, I might add, okay? Since that time, they've actually tweaked that a little bit more. Okay? Are these slides in that thing? Okay, good. Most of them. Yeah, there may be some additions and subtractions. But anyway, what they found, remember that 800 milligram level? What the researchers since that time have found that it makes a difference not just if they got any, but it makes a difference how much and what the quality actually was. Okay? Look at these calves. Calves with serum IgG1 levels up to 2,500 milligrams per deciliter, 1.5 times more likely to get sick before weaning, 2.4 times more likely to die before weaning than calves with higher IgG1 levels. Look at this. Calves with IgG1 levels of at least 2,700 milligrams per deciliter weighed 7.38 pounds more 205 days of age than calves with lower levels. What's that mean? Does that mean we're going to go out there and measure every calf? Does that mean we're going to start stripping beef cows out and make sure they got enough? And no, of course not. It means that you and I, in our decisions, in our daily activities, in our animal husbandry skills, need to do whatever we can to ensure that that event of that calf getting up and nursing under as least stressful conditions as possible actually takes place, and that the cow is in good enough condition, she actually has colostrum, actually has milk, and the calf is able to nurse it. It sounds simple enough, but there's a lot of things that can screw that thing up, that make that event not as easily to attain as you might think. Okay? Just going to show you a couple pictures of what screws that up. Okay? Kansas State Veterinary Clinic, probably 1991, something like that. 125-pound calf. We pulled out of a pretty big Simmental cow. And I say pull, and that's mild. Okay? We in veterinary language like to use terms that sometimes makes it sound better than it really was. Okay? This is called a forceful extraction. You kind of know what that means? It means we pulled the hell out of that calf, is what we did. Okay? And I want you to notice something about this calf. He's got some brown staining on the white part of his hide. What is that? You guys know what that is. What is that? What?
Meconium.
Yes, meconium. I bet you got A's in all your class in college, didn't you?
We just got a good vet.
Okay. That's meconium. Okay? That's a nice term for what? Yeah, that's right. That guy set it up here. I didn't say that, but it's manure, okay? Do all calves that are born come that way? No, they don't, do they? What's that a symptom of? What does that tell us about that calf? Were you on this deal, Lonnie? Were you delivering that calf? Okay. Yeah, okay. Let's not go there. I didn't say that, okay? That's not me. All right, what's that a symptom of, though? Yes, it's a symptom of stress in the life of that calf at that point. Even though we took that calf, tubed that calf, milked out that cow, fed it colostrum, drug it around the front, bonded with the cow, that calf has been under a stressful situation, and he's got higher cortisol levels, probably amongst other things, probably not going to absorb that immunity from that colostrum as well as a calf that's born unassisted. My point being is that if we don't pay attention to calving ease, we can get ourselves into trouble with things like scours outbreaks. And in addition to that cow that we had to forcefully extract that calf is probably not going to breed back very well either. Okay? That's why that calving ease is so critical for us. Okay? Directly related to health, directly related to breed back ability. What about this over here? Flint Hills of Kansas sometime in March, freezing rain. Okay? You think those calves are non-stressed? No, they're pretty stressed. Some of you in this room from Kansas remember in 1996, I believe it was, when we had that March blizzard. We had a lot of calves die in Kansas from hypothermia. A couple weeks later, we had more scours in the Flint Hills than I think they've ever had before. Okay? Is it an infectious disease problem or what? No, it's a stress problem, really. Okay? So what's the answer to that? We talked about changing calving seasons, and I know that's not an easy decision to arrive at, except calving seasons, in my mind, need to be done when it's least amount of stress to the calf, and I might add, as well as to the owner. Okay? Okay. I think, actually, these are two more Kansas cows, believe it or not. What about this deal here? I don't know that there's any EPDs for teat and udder conformation. Probably should be. I know ABS tried this for a while. What do you think the risk is of this calf getting disease when he's born to a cow like this? Probably higher. I'm not telling you that these calves that are born under difficult situations or circumstances will always be the ones that get sick. I'm just saying that the risk is higher. Okay? Let's say this calf does get up and nurse and he gets some colostrum. Maybe he's the one that's just slightly lighter in the fall, like I showed you earlier with that data. Okay? This first calf heifer over here calved with mastitis. Her calf, I watched that calf, spent about a half an hour trying to nurse that cow. Couldn't do it because she was kicking him. Her udder was sore. Is that calf at a greater risk of sickness? Absolutely. Okay? Absolutely. Dave touched on this. He touched on this rebreeding ability of these cows that are in poor body condition score. What's the body condition score you think of this cow right here? What do you think? 3 maybe? Daryl, what do you say? 2.5? I don't know. She's not very good, is she? What we know about this is that cows that are in poor body condition score have lower quality colostrum than cows that are in good breed. Okay? So not only is this a rebreeding issue, again, it's a health issue. Okay? And I want you to think of how many traits we have talked about in these last slides. This one, udder and teat conformation, calving ease, are related to your ability to select cattle in the first place. If we don't have those bases covered, if you don't have that cow herd of yours in the position to, in the best position possible from a genetic standpoint, to reduce cost of production and promote as good health in those calves as possible, then we're kind of lost. You can't make any progress. Okay? What's also interesting about this, and I don't have a slide on this, I took it out on purpose, is that those risk factors that I talked about, of that calf not getting up, not getting enough to nurse, whatever reason, appears to follow that calf even after weaning. Okay? That was a huge revelation to me. That's not just an early life effect. That actually follows those calves after weaning. Okay? All right. Switch gears. Okay? I'm going to talk about vaccines just a little bit. The reason I spent as much time in pictures as I did with the first part is that it doesn't make any sense for me to talk about this unless we've got the first part of that deal covered. Okay? All right. I actually borrowed some of this stuff several years ago from Louis Perino. My friend, we used to write that Beef Magazine article, and he decided that the challenges were not large enough in the veterinary profession. He's now in med school. Okay? Anyway, getting back to this issue right here, I just want to spend a little bit of time so that we have a clear understanding of what vaccines really do and how they work within the herd setting. And I'm going to use this population in here to make my point. Okay? Vaccines contains material from disease-causing bugs, and we give those materials to animals to stimulate a response by the body. Okay? We want antibodies produced, we want killer cells produced, and we want memory cells produced. Okay? What many of us tend to forget, I'm in the same boat in many cases. I automatically assume that if I inject an animal with a vaccine, that somehow I've achieved this. Immunization, not necessarily. Okay? I have to confess something to you. I actually ran some cows through just the other day, and I know you all know that it does get cold in North Dakota occasionally, and it happened to be the day it was fairly cold. When I got down to the last five cows, I had some frozen vaccine in my syringe. Okay? Is that stuff likely any good? Did it do any good? Probably not. Okay? I wasn't careful enough about handling that vaccine. Just because I injected it and I had to squeeze a little bit harder because it was kind of solid in that syringe, just because I injected that stuff into that cow doesn't mean I achieved immunization. Probably didn't. Okay? I have to have an effective vaccine. I have to have a vaccine that I didn't abuse. And I have to have an animal that's able to respond. Okay? I'm going to talk about this thing very briefly. What has to happen in that immune response? Hang with me. Okay? Don't get too sleepy here. I am pretty good at spotting sleepers. Okay? So hang with me. I'm just going to use a schematic to try and illustrate what happens in the body of an animal when you give a vaccine to develop that immune response. Okay? This antigen up here is actually the vaccine. It's recognized by a cell in the body called a macrophage. That's the recognition phase. Okay? Then we actually have an activation phase. We get a whole bunch of stuff going on here. Okay? By now you should have in your mind that this is a fairly complex procedure that I have made very simple. And it's not this simple. All right? And then in the end, I've got some effects. I've got some antibody production and I've got some cells that are produced that actually do the job, that actually provide the immunization, that actually provide the protection for that animal. Okay? All right. It is complicated and it takes time. This immune response takes a little bit longer with naive animals. Okay? So you can see I'm going fairly fast here, but I know you can follow along with your notes. All right? The interesting thing about vaccinations is that they're not all the same. They're not all the same in terms of developing a protective immune response in terms of time. Okay? Modified live IBR vaccines, man, we can get protection in a hurry. Okay? BVD vaccines aren't that way. Okay? Don't know why necessarily. A lot of things that are GOK in this, in the scientific realm. God only knows. Okay? This is one of those. And you can see that for different disease-causing bugs, it's a little bit different in terms of how quickly you might be able to get an immune response. Okay? The good thing is that because we have, or we can induce a memory response in animals, is that when we give a vaccine again, or if we expose those animals a second time to a disease-causing agent, we can shorten the time and raise the immunity level. And that's great, okay? But I want to focus on this right here. I actually want to increase the number of immune animals. And if you take nothing else away from what I'm going to talk about today, it's this concept of herd immunity. All right? Herd immunity. Most of us in this room understand this. Individual vaccination or individual immunization, okay, where we get protection against disease, in other words, against clinical signs. We reduce the susceptibility of an individual against infection, and we reduce the infectivity after the occurrence of an infection. That's individual immunization. There are some diseases for which this is very important. I might use as an example the West Nile virus in horses. It's extremely important for us to get individual immunization with that particular vaccine. Okay? Because what do we know about West Nile? Does it spread from horse to horse? No, it doesn't, does it? It spreads by what? Mosquitoes. Okay? I guess if we could vaccinate mosquitoes, we'd be okay. Think about building a squeeze chute for a mosquito or something like that. That's where the target would be better served in terms of herd immunity, but that's not what we're after with West Nile virus. We're after individual vaccination. I want you to contrast that. Now, I want you to think about the difference between individual and herd immunity. Okay? What we are trying to do with herd immunity is reduce the probability, the chances, of an individual becoming infected when it's part of a vaccinated population. Okay? Let's say that everybody in this room is vaccinated for a certain disease. Will all of you in this room respond to that vaccine? No, you won't. There will be some of you that will not. There will be some of you that will respond very well. And yet if I have one person in here that comes in infected, those of you that are immunized have the ability to stop transmission of that bug to such an extent that the ones who didn't get immunized are actually protected. That's the concept behind herd immunity. Okay? We would like to have everybody immunized, but we recognize that in field situations, that's not often very possible. Okay? So we're trying to reduce the probability of an individual becoming infected when it's part of that population. Okay? The chance of becoming infected in a population decreases with increasing density of individuals being vaccinated. In other words, if I have 80% of you immunized in here, the chances of you getting that disease are less in contrast to if there was only 30% of you immunized. Okay? What we'd really like to do is stop transmission of that bug entirely because there's enough of you immunized. All right? This is probably the most extreme case. It's perhaps just like this room, if you and I lived in this room for the next 4 months or so. Okay? This is somewhat similar. What we're actually trying to do in many of these pens is achieve as high of an immunization rate as possible such that we decrease transmission of virus or bacteria from one animal to another. That's why we oftentimes will use revaccination strategies in feedlots. Vaccinate them once, twice, sometimes even three times. Okay? Okay. I hesitated to even show you this one because it can be a little bit confusing. Okay? What I'm trying to convey here is that if you're immunized, if this whole room is totally susceptible to an agent, okay? Let's say you're totally susceptible to red nose in this room. And Daryl is infected with red nose. And we live together for a little while. How many of you will become infected with red nose because Daryl was infected? Okay? That's the idea behind this particular term here. How many new cases arise from one? For red nose, it's somewhere around 6. Okay? And then what happens is, with a susceptible population, we have explosive growth, don't we? Because the next one will get 6. The next one will get 6. Eventually, we get to the point where the population starts to become immune. With vaccination or immunization, we try and head that off, don't we? We're trying to stop the transmission of that virus such that it doesn't spread at all. Okay? Is there a question back there? I heard something. Question? Oh, really? How could you? Is that allowed in here? Daryl, aren't you the, the hall monitor? Send them to the principal. Okay. The truth of it is that each pathogen has a little bit different picture in terms of this, how many new cases arise from one in susceptible populations. Look at this. Immunization for herd immunity against BVD needs to be at least almost 60% in herds without PI animals. What time is it, Daryl? Am I running in trouble? 11 o'clock. Okay, we're okay. Without PI animals. How many of you in this room know what a PI animal is? Ooh. Okay, some of you do, some of you don't. We're going to get there in a hurry. If I have PI animals or animals that always carry BVD in their system, it's almost impossible. Because those animals are shedding BVD constantly, I have to have almost 100% immunized. Difficult to achieve. For IBR, I probably need 86%. Look at this. For pseudorabies, if I have one animal that's infected and a susceptible population, I have 10 more that are infected from that one. Okay? All right. Before I go to this, does that kind of make sense? Either yes or no, or a little bit. Okay. There's some of this stuff that we as veterinarians don't talk about very much. Okay. So I understand if maybe you haven't heard some of this stuff before. We should talk about it a whole lot more. Okay. Because that's the way it works in populations of animals, which is what all of us deal with. All right. Okay. But to change this equation just a little bit, and perhaps to raise the bar even a little bit higher, for some diseases, we have decided that even the individual animal is not necessarily enough in terms of being protected, or the herd necessarily. What we're looking at now is, how can we actually protect the fetus that may be vulnerable to some of these bugs and pathogens? Okay? So we're actually trying to protect this growing and developing fetus while it's still inside the cow. Is that a feat that's easy to accomplish? Not in your life, it's not. Okay? The fetus can be fairly susceptible to some of these things that come along. And it's primarily due to the fact the way this fetus is developing in there. Okay? We actually can get infectious disease agents that want to cross this placenta and get to this fetus and cause various sorts of things. Might cause abortions, okay? Might cause early embryonic death, okay? We actually might, at certain times, certain stages of gestation, we may actually cause this fetus to mount an immune response and get along and do just fine, okay? All right. So remember that it's oftentimes not necessarily just enough to protect this cow. We're actually looking at things trying to protect this fetus as well. All right. So what's it important for? I mean, what diseases are we really talking about? I'm not going to talk about all these, okay? I'm primarily going to focus on BVD. But we do, in fact, need fetal protection for IBR. Can cause abortions. Lepto can cause abortions. Okay? BVD can cause these persistently infected animals. Vibrio can cause early embryonic death, as well as trichomoniasis can cause abortions. And Neospora. Okay? So there are a number of disease-causing agents for which we would like to have some data that tells us, yeah, that fetus seems to be protected. Or the cow has enough immunity in her system such that she actually protects that fetus. Okay? Doesn't allow that disease agent to cross that placenta and infect that fetus. Okay? I just got one slide up here because I want to bring your attention to the fact that this is a disease that we have, for a long time, kind of just assumed that we've got it covered. Lepto's not a big deal. We've kind of got it covered. There's some fairly recent information that might indicate that that's not quite correct. Okay? That there may be some strains of lepto that we're not doing a very good job on at all. Okay? So I just want you to bring that to your attention, to not discount the impact that lepto may be having. We haven't got this thing entirely figured out yet, but there may be a strain of lepto that we haven't given very much attention to in this country that may require some scrutiny and may require some diagnostics and perhaps some protection. Okay? All right. I'm not sure what this thing is doing, Daryl, but it's doing funny things. It's probably telling me to hurry up. Okay? Okay. The final slides I'm going to talk about are concerning BVD. So zero your minds in on this BVD. I'm going to talk about PI animals, persistently infected animals. Those are animals that carry BVD in the system and are a source of infection for the entire population. Okay? All right. How are they created? They're created because they develop an infection while they're inside the cow, while they're developing an in utero. Most often they develop this way. A non-immunized pregnant cow is exposed to a certain type of BVD, and she's pregnant, and that calf is infected with virus at that time, does not abort, goes to term, okay? And now we have an animal on our farm, ranch, whatever, that's a constant source of BVD. The other way this can actually happen is sometimes those animals appear to be very healthy, and they somehow get back into our herds. And so if they are back into our herds and they're persistently infected, remember I told you that once infected this way, in utero, that they're always infected until they die. Okay? And if you have cows in your herd that are persistently infected, they will always give rise to the birth of a persistently infected calf. Okay? Two ways. All right. So what's the big deal? The big deal is that those PI animals shed large amounts of virus. Constant source of infection. Very efficient transmission of virus. That's why it's so difficult for us to achieve high enough immunization rates to prevent the spread of virus if we have PI animals in the herd. It's virtually impossible. That's why the first course of action, if you suspect BVD in your herd, is to identify whether you've got PI animals in there in the first place. Okay? It's an extremely important part of BVD control. Here's something else I want you to make sure you take home from here. We in this cow-calf industry in particular have been pretty laid back about bringing animals onto our place. One of the worst things that I see almost every year during the spring is that we'll lose a calf for whatever reason, and we'll go get a calf and bring it on the place. I hope that if I asked you right now to raise your hand and tell me how many of you have done that within the last year, that nobody would raise their hand. Don't do that. Okay? Don't do that. You're better off letting that cow go dry. Tremendous breach of biosecurity when you do things like that. The possibility of bringing PI animals into your herd is too great. I also want to give you this example, okay? If we assume that there's 2% PIs across the country, let's say I go out and buy 20 cows of unknown origin. Good, they were good buy at the sale barn. They look great, okay? What's my chances of bringing a PI onto my place? I'm not smart enough to have developed this mathematical equation, but if you actually do the math here, if I purchase 20 animals and the prevalence is 2%, the risk is 33% of bringing one animal, PI animal, onto the place. Okay? I'm telling you that sort of practice in our industry can't go on. Okay? If you're going to bring unknown animals, you better have them tested. Or you better have an idea where they came from. Better have an idea of the disease status in that place that you're buying them from. It's too great of a risk. Okay? All right. Just to finish up, one of the commonly held, in my mind, misperceptions is that all vaccines are created equal. Okay? The truth of it is, they're not. Okay? And maybe these types of experiments are the highest standard for which we can hold vaccines. I just want to show you that when we talk about this business of providing fetal protection, of providing enough immunity in that cow to protect that fetus such that that calf doesn't become a PI animal, not all vaccines are created equal. I'm not going to show you just slide after slide, trial after trial. I'm just going to show you a few just to demonstrate my point. This happens to be two killed vaccines, two different vaccines applied twice within a 3-month interval. Okay? All calves born from unvaccinates were born PI, which tells you that the challenge model was great. I mean, it did exactly what it was supposed to. But look at this. 6 out of 9 were born PI from one vaccine. 8 out of 15 were born PI from the second vaccine. Don't just assume that because a vaccine has this or that type or different strains in it, somehow you're getting better protection. I'm telling you that we need to be skeptics in this industry. We need to say, yeah, show me. I need to see the data. If you have a Pfizer TM come to your place and he tells you some of these things, yep, shows you some great vaccine that provides fetal protection, say, yeah, that's fine, show me the data. Okay? We need to be skeptics. We can't just accept all of the colored brochures that come our way. Okay? I apologize for showing you sheep vaccine studies, okay? But it serves to make my point. Fetuses from ewes immunized, and you hear a lot about this BVD type 1 and type 2 business. Fetuses from ewes immunized with BVD1 were protected when challenged with BVD2. All fetuses were infected from ewes immunized with BVD2 and challenged with BVD1. Okay? So don't just make these assumptions just because vaccine A has type 1, type 2, that somehow we're getting better protection. It's not necessarily so. I'm not saying it's not so, but demand to look at the data. Right? I think I just got 2 slides left. I just wanted to share with you the BovaShield data, just to make sure that you're clear as to what BovaShield looks like when it comes to these challenges. Okay? 1 out of 38 vaccinates had a PI calf. 7 out of the 10 control calves, in other words, born to non-immunized cows, were born PI. Okay? Interestingly enough, there was no difference between single and two doses. There's not enough numbers in these animals to try and apply some of these herd immunity principles necessarily here. Okay? But I don't want you to forget the herd immunity principles we talked about and how important it is to have enough animals immune in a population such that these viruses don't spread and transmit from animal to animal. Type 2 challenge, 13 out of 37 vaccinates had PIs. 9 out of 10 control calves were born PI. It's about 60%. Would I have loved to have seen that higher? Absolutely. Okay? Remember, though, that these are challenge models and that every cow gets a whopping dose of BVD virus up the nose. Okay? Is it likely to occur that way in field exposure? Not likely. Okay? Not likely. A couple points to remember. It's going to be difficult to achieve complete reproductive BVD protection from vaccination. You got to be able to remove PIs, You got to have some type of biosecurity. In other words, how do I keep the viruses out of my herd in the first place? Okay? Vaccination alone is not going to achieve that status. IBR protection, on the other hand, seems to be pretty darn strong. Okay? Do not overpromise what vaccination can do. Think of the breeder cubes. Okay? Incorporate vaccination with other control measures, biosecurity, and testing. I'm done. I'm not sure I made it on time, but I was close. Many of you perhaps are ready for lunch. I understand that's at 11:30 or something like that. But I appreciate the chance to stand up here and give you almost somewhat of a philosophy along with a little bit of science of how I look at our industry. Okay? Remember the quality issue. Remember the herd immunity issue. If you take nothing else away from here, remember those issues. That's the business that we're in. Thanks a lot. I appreciate every one of you. What's that?